This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss the report that's been released from the Senate on American torture. Although redacted, the report is utterly shocking. Let's hope we get prosecutions of Bush, Cheney, and the CIA torture team soon in this country or in another one.
We'll take a look at secrecy and conflicts of interest that exist within investigations of police violence cases.
We'll be talking with Bina Ahmad, a criminal defense lawyer on Staten Island, the very place Eric Garner was murdered.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, after 4 years and $40 million, the Senate committee finally came out with his report on torture. I don't know if they used the word torture. And tell us about what went into this.
Well, it's true that the Senate committee came out with the report, but it really wasn't their fault for a lot of the delay. They started the investigation, the Senate Committee on Intelligence started the investigation in 2007 after, I think, some 92 tapes of waterboarding were destroyed by the CIA. And that's where the investigation began. In 2009, the Senate committee, still controlled by the Democrats, spent 4 years going through millions of documents at a high cost to try and come out with a report on the CIA's role in what they called detention and interrogation program. I think that's sort of an anodyne and inoffensive name for what should be called the disappearance and torture program, because that's what it is. They called it detention and interrogation. We call it disappearance and torture. In any case, after 4 years, they came out with a 6,700-page report in 2012, and they decided only to release the executive summary. So what all the tumult is about now is the executive summary of some 500 pages. And it was heavily redacted, not because the Senate wanted it redacted, but because the CIA fought tooth and nail over the redactions. And the Obama White House, Obama himself, actually supported having more and more redactions. There was a point when Senator Feinstein, who is usually the best friends of the intelligence agency, said, we're not going to issue this report. The redactions are so great, even in this executive summary, that it won't be comprehensible. But despite that, we're seeing a tremendous amount of press and action around the report. We'll see how long it acts on what we have now, how long it lasts for. But what we have now is a 500-page executive summary, heavily redacted. Before I ask you the question, Michael, we already notice how stupid those redactions are, because they redact like the names of the countries where the CIA ran black sites. They call them, like, one is called Cobalt. Well, everybody who's out there in my field knows that Cobalt refers to what's called the salt pit in Afghanistan, which is a CIA-run detention facility north of Kabul. We know that other names like Black, Gray, were in Poland, were in Thailand, etc. So they made these redactions that just make, that just are ridiculous. So that's part of what we're seeing. So rather than give my immediate reaction to the substance of this report, I'd like to hear from my two co-hosts, Michael Smith and Heidi Boghossian, what their feeling is about the importance or non-importance of this report.
Well, we've been covering this ever since it started on Law and Disorder. But I have to say, I was shocked by this report in three respects. For one thing, the line was more than I thought. The brutality was more than I thought. The corruption was more than I thought. On the line, this report states that no lives were saved as a consequence of this program. Zero. The brutality was much worse than we had thought. We knew about waterboarding, yes, but we didn't know about rectal feeding and rectal hydration, where they left one man with a prolapsed rectum, which means it's hanging out. We didn't know about killing people by chaining them to the floor in a cold room and dousing them with water. We didn't know about the kind of details that we find in this report. And we didn't know about the corruption. this program was run by two amateur psychologists who didn't know anything about Arab culture, who didn't know anything about interrogation. They set up a corporation, and the government gave them $81 million of our dollars to run this thing from 2002 to 2007. If you do the numbers, these guys probably made about $5 million a year less expenses. They became millionaires, these two psychologists.
Michael, do you recall the names?
Yeah, I do.
I'm asking you for a particular reason.
They changed the names
right.
of the report.
We've known these guys forever. These are the original people who, you know, taught about learned helplessness years ago. And based on these experiments that made no sense and never were verified, and they actually use what do you call them, pseudonyms in the report.
Yeah.
One is named Jessen, and what's the other
Mitchell.
Guy? Mitchell and Jessen. Yeah. And these are the guys who got $80 million and did 85% of the interrogations through their, quote, interrogation.
That's
company.
Right. They farmed it out. They right. privatized these interrogations. So my reaction was, the bottom line on this, which no one's talking about, particularly the New York Times, is that the it's what Martin Luther King said, that this is the most violent country in the world. The CIA is the epitome of this. The last time they were investigated 39 years ago by the Church Committee, it was found that they ran an assassination program. This time they were investigated and found they run a torture program. Torture is illegal under American law, under international law. People who do it should be prosecuted. People who authorize it should be prosecuted, and there's no talk about that. So my reaction is that this thing was much worse than we thought, and nothing's going to be done about it. Heidi, what do you think?
My number one takeaway is, again, something we've covered on Law and Disorder for years, and that is that no actionable intelligence came out as a result of these heinous practices. We've known that, but I think this shows that. And the other thing that
they went through 20 incidents where the CIA claimed they'd stop plots.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think what also offends me greatly is hearing George W. Bush's response that anyone who sort of buys into this report or gives it credence is somehow unpatriotic, which fits in with the whole propaganda that we've been fed, especially since the events of 9/11, that questioning anything the government does is an offense or an affront. And I think that's outrageous given what Michael Smith just outlined in terms of, once again, contractors engaging in illegal activities.
I want to say a word about this question of no lives were saved by it, because it's quite important in two respects for me. One is that even if lives were saved, this is flatly illegal. It's not like you can say you can bomb Hiroshima because we're going to save lives of people hitting Omaha Beach or whatever beach is in Japan, not Omaha. I mean, you can't do illegal acts. You can't kill a million civilians because you want to save some of your soldiers. And that's this case. So the first thing that hits me is that this is illegal altogether. The second thing is this point about it saving lives. And, of course, that they destroyed the CIA on. And one thing that made me reflect on was, in the report, it says the CIA had already said before 9/11 that torture doesn't work. It's not effective. They obviously knew this wasn't working. And there's instances in this where they have people like in this coffin or waterboarding. And they say he doesn't know anymore. He doesn't know about American plots. And they continued to do it for the next week.
Right.
What it brought me back to was when we interviewed, what's the woman from Algeria, Michael Smith?
Marnia
Lazreg. The professor who wrote a book
on torture.
Right. And what she said was interesting because it was about torture in Algeria. And it was saying this was not really about information. This was about the end of a macho empire that was in decline. And they were going to torture the people sitting across from them. And so when you put together the facts, they knew it wouldn't work before 9/11. They didn't get any actionable intelligence from it during 9/11. And so what are you saying here except that this is about torturing Muslims? It's about empire, and it's about telling the world, you fall into our hands, we're going to torture you.
Now, Dianne Feinstein says, we have to issue this report. We have to show that, quote, this is not who we are. Precisely who you are. Not me, not you, Michael, not Heidi, not our listeners, not the American people, to the extent they haven't been BS'd about this and scared about this and told that this saved their lives and told that this is how Osama bin Laden was tracked down. It's all lies. This is how you are. And if you want to actually show that you're not like this, you should prosecute the people who did it, all the way up to George Bush.
There were lots of, like, remarkable things in here, but there was one piece in the
was about CIA, report says CIA used media links to advantage. Now, of course, that you would expect. What they did was, on the highest levels of the CIA, they went to places like the New York Times and the Washington Post, and they wanted to be identified as a high, you know, administration or intelligence official, and they leaked the stories of what they were doing in a way that would give them credit for it. And some of the papers bought into that, and that's how you got things like that movie Zero Dark Thirty. But one of the most egregious examples, seems to me, of the manipulation and the failure of our newspapers to cover it was the Times discovered in 2002 that Abu Zubaydah was one of the people that was waterboarded, someone who they believed had information about plots in the United States. In fact, he didn't. Was taken to Thailand, which was one of the so-called black sites where he was tortured and waterboarded, presumably in Thailand, perhaps at another location. And the Times had news of that in 2002, and they refused to allow it to be printed because of their fears that it would offend the countries where it were, and they wouldn't be able to get other countries to involve themselves in the program. Here they take a man to a secret detention where he's going to be tortured, and the Times refuses to print it until 2003. And we know it's Thailand because James Risen, who's, of course, been doing incredible reporting and wrote this recent book on military, reported that the country was Thailand. Heidi?
Michael, I wanted to add the fact that junior officers were not supervised properly and were sort of given carte blanche at some of these detention facilities, including at one called Cobalt, where they held mock executions without approval from the CIA. Yeah.
No, that's right. It is referred to only as Cobalt. It's actually the Salt Pit, which we knew called the Salt Pit. And it's been, people who like do this work immediately said Cobalt is the Salt Pit.
So we know there's no accountability in a larger sense, but there's also internally a Wild West mentality, it seems, where junior officials can just do what they want with impunity.
That's completely clear.
There's nothing.
There's nothing. And then to the extent that they were worried about accountability, they destroyed all the tapes.
Well, let me say something about that. Jose Rodriguez was one of the guys in charge of the torture program. He's the guy that destroyed the 92 videotapes that would have been used as evidence against him. Why did he destroy those tapes? Because earlier in his career, he was stationed in Buenos Aires. There was a coup, a military coup there in 1977. The countries that refused to go along with the United States isolating Cuba had their democratic governments overthrown, and Argentina was one of many in those days. And Rodriguez was down there, and he saw that the military dictatorship in Argentina was torturing people. And then he saw just recently that those military people are being prosecuted in Argentina, some 200, I think, Michael. I was down there a few months ago when the trials were going on, and Rodriguez, you know, knew. He didn't have to be real smart to figure out that he should destroy the evidence because one of those days he could be prosecuted too.
That is why I think, Michael, that I'm not hopeless about prosecutions, because ultimately, maybe not here, but somewhere in the world, these people will be held accountable.
Let me tell you about one prosecution. It's called the Nuremberg prosecutions that were used by the United States and the victorious Allies in 1942 when fascism in Europe was defeated. The Germans at that time had a torture program. They didn't call it that. What did they call it? They called it enhanced interrogation techniques. Just what it's called here in the pages of the New York Times and on the lips of Obama. In German, it's called Verschärfte Vernehmung.
This was a very good article in The Atlantic talking about how that exactly what you said, Michael, enhanced interrogation was used by the Gestapo, and our enhanced interrogation is actually worse than the Gestapo's.
And when the Nazis who tortured people pled mitigating circumstances, like we didn't torture everybody, we were nice to some people, and so on, they were still tried, found guilty, and condemned, and given the death penalty. Now, I'm not saying we should give George Bush the death penalty, but what I am saying is that Bush and Cheney, I used to wear a T-shirt that said, arrest Cheney first, thanks to Laurie Arbeiter, and the lawyers who who said this program was
John,
legal.
You, Jay Bybee.
And one other guy, David Addington.
Right.
Bybee became a federal judge. John, you has a chaired professorship at the University of California Law School in Berkeley. I don't know what happened to Addington. These guys have all profited from their torturing people, and they've all been let off the hook.
One point I want to make about this is only talking about what the CIA did at the dark sites, nine dark sites around the world. The CIA claimed there were 98 people that were in dark sites. In fact, they lied, and in fact, Hayden, who was head of the CIA, told them to continue to lie that it was 98.
Keep the numbers down.
In fact, it was 129, I think, 126. Yeah. Anyway, so the point I want to make is that there was torture going on in all kinds of other places. For example, the center represents Guantanamo people. 700 people went through Guantanamo. That's the Rumsfeld techniques. Torture throughout Guantanamo, torture at Abu Ghraib, torture at other U.S. prisons. So we're talking about a very small subset of U.S. torture, a horrible one because of the waterboarding in particular and because of the confinement in coffins,
right.
You know, these small spaces where Abu Zubaydah was put into a coffin for days, you know, 2.5 feet wide, 2.5 feet high, and basically looked like a coffin, apparently crying, all these other things while he's doing it. I mean, it completely destroyed people as human beings. And he actually didn't have any information that they wanted.
Right.
But I just want to point out, this is a small part of the program.
The only person so far to be prosecuted by the federal government for his relationship to torture was a CIA agent named John Kerouac, who's sitting in prison now. Why? Because he blew the whistle on waterboarding. The only person to be prosecuted is a whistleblower.
You know, because we do a fair amount on Palestine and Israel here. Oh, Israel did come up in the torture report in this. And the headline of the Haaretz article on this says, CIA cited Israeli Supreme Court ruling to justify torture. And they talk about the Israeli Supreme Court's ruling that you can't use torture except. And the except is where there's no other available means to prevent harm to other people. Now, of course, as we said, you can never use torture. There's no such thing as really a ticking time bomb scenario that allows you to use it. But in fact, as the report says, there was no situations like that, even assuming that might be an exception for some nut in the CIA to use that exception, or for the Israelis. There is no exception for that, but that's not what happened here. And in fact, in some of the cases the report brings out, they started waterboarding people before they even tried to interrogate them in a friendly manner.
Yeah.
So they went straight to that.
Right,
so that's why I think it goes just to the point of this is about macho brutality of a declining empire.
I would add that it's about profit. The role that private corporations, which, as we've discussed before, is virtually inseparable in terms of intelligence and national security functions with the government. They're inextricably entwined, and these companies are profiting off torture. So why do we go straight to the torture? Because they bring them in for their expertise in that, and they make millions and millions of dollars off of it.
I think we should... As we close this little discussion, talk about prosecutions a bit and some of what's been happening. A key turn on prosecutions of the torturers happened when Obama took office. Obama had the opportunity at that point to say, I am going to prosecute people and I'm going to have investigations. Instead, he said, we're going to look forward and not backward, which means to say we're going to have a future without torture, but the past will let be. And of course, the two problems with that is, a future without torture, assuming we can even believe what's happening here, and I have some issues about that, is only done by executive order by Obama. So the next president, or if there's another, quote, 9/11 crisis, they can begin torturing again. You need to look back because you need to prosecute people as a deterrence against torture. So Obama did the key pivot away. When people say, why did he do it? You're reading a lot about, well, we couldn't convict people in an American court, all of that. You know, I don't think that's the case, but in fact, he made the decision because, let's face it, this country is run by the military, the CIA, the intelligence agencies, and Obama was unwilling to buck them, which is why the head of the CIA today is someone who was in the CIA in the very division that authorized and approved a lot of the torture,
John Brennan.
So that's where the turn happened. Now what you're seeing is people out there, a lot of them my friends, acquaintances, saying, well, it's impossible to get prosecutions here. Oh, we can't do it. Let's give up on this idea. We can't do it. In fact, there was a very odd editorial to me by Anthony Romero, who is I consider to be very strong on
going after these guys, and the ACLU has been very good on this, that we should give pardons to people. And his theory, well, his theory is
I read it.
That if you pardon someone, it's basically admitting that they have a crime. They've committed a crime. Now, my view is that's not the best idea I ever heard, but it was. I think it was done to be provocative, to get people to say, well, maybe this is an idea. It's not only not the best idea, it's unlawful and illegal. You certainly can't pardon them for international crimes, which these are, and so outside the country it wouldn't have any effect. Inside, perhaps, but I can't imagine a campaign that says, oh, let's pardon Cheney. Or that Obama's, right. Or that the chances of Obama giving a pardon is any better than the chances of him actually beginning investigations and prosecuting people. I understand he's frustrated because ACLU has been trying to get these people, like the Center for Constitutional Rights has, for a long time. But on the other hand, it doesn't seem like the best idea. I'll just, Heidi, in 1 second, I just want to say the last word on this is that, for my word, is that I think this will renew the call for international prosecutions all over the world.
Yes.
The center has one going in Spain. We tried Germany, Switzerland. It's going to keep going. I'm sorry. Heidi wants to.
I was just actually going to ask about that. What do you think is going to be the fallout and the actions that groups and people take across the globe?
Well, the UN special rapporteur on this called for prosecutions yesterday. So I agree with you, Michael. I think that this isn't going to quiet things down. And we only got 500 pages out of a 6,000-page report. People are wondering, what else did they do?
Now, the question that begs is that in terms of increasing global anger toward the United States,
the CIH and its allies, including the State Department a bit, Kerry and others, they kept saying you can't give this details because people are going to kill more Americans. They're going to go after our embassies. They're going to do all this stuff. Now, they just quoted somebody in an article I read, an official from Yemen, who said, this is old story to us. We know the U.S. engages in torture. We're upset that they're droning our people to death. This is not about, this report. The U.S. engages in torture. They said, we know that. That's not what's doing it. I mean, if you're talking about what's doing it, it's, the Iraq war, it's bombings in Syria. I mean, come on. It's like, this is like simply an excuse to try and keep the report hidden.
Yeah, I think it's what we've seen before. It's nothing but fear-mongering. That's what Kerry did with this. They used fear-mongering to do torture to begin with, and now they're using fear-mongering to cover it up.
And in fact, if we're worried about people being upset with the United States, they're upset because we torture. That's why they're upset. They're upset because we make war. They're upset because we use drones, not because it comes out publicly that that's what we did, but because we actually engage in torture, and we did it broadly enough that it's broadly known in the world. Just to close out this segment on torture, you can go to the Center for Constitutional Rights website. Our position at the center is there must be prosecutions, whether both here and internationally. Is it the only thing you can do to stop torture? No, but is it an absolute necessity to use it against the United States and its officials? Absolutely, yes. Go to the CCR website. The website is ccrjustice.org, ccrjustice.org. Sign the petition. Get involved in making sure that we can actually have some accountability for what I call the torture team.
A recent Vanity Fair article titled "Eric Garner's Public Defender Says Cops and Prosecutors Are a Team in Every Case" exposes the secrecy and conflicts of interest in investigations of police violence. It details how 7 of the 10 most sued police officers of the 35,000-member New York Police Department happen to live in Staten Island. The article was written by attorneys Bina Ahmad, Joseph Doyle, and Michael Rooney, all public defenders in Staten Island with the Legal Aid Society. We also get a look inside grand jury proceedings and the often biased investigations from district attorneys' offices when looking into police wrongdoing. What steps are needed to structure fair court proceedings in these cases? We ask Bina Ahmad, National Lawyers Guild member and staff attorney in the Criminal Defense Practice Department of the Legal Aid Society. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Bina.
Thank you for having me.
Bina, you're a practicing criminal defense lawyer out in Staten Island with the Legal Aid Society, you probably more than anybody would know the answer to this question. How do the cops out there treat people in the non-white communities of Staten Island?
I have to say it's pretty brutal, and in my view, I think it's very obvious it is discriminatory and predatory policing. As my colleagues Joseph Doyle and Michael Rooney and many other colleagues have noted, but in our article we noted in the Vanity Fair article that 7 of the top 10 most sued officers in all of the 5 boroughs of New York City Police Department officers are in Staten Island. So 7 of the top 10 most officers have been accused of the most brutal and heinous treatment of people work here in Staten Island.
And they still work there?
Are still work here, still make arrests. They still testify in court, you know, swear under oath that they're telling the truth. They still violate our clients' rights with impunity, left and right, commit violent acts against them just during even the most routine stops. Even though Staten Island probably has a higher mix of not just clients of color, but I have a lot of white clients as well, my other colleagues do. The disparate treatment, not only in the way that our clients of color are treated, I think in a much more brutal way and being handled more roughly, but also in the way that they're charged and the plea offers that they're given, is very stark and very discriminatory in my mind.
Let me ask you, because it's interesting, 7 out of 10 of the police officers most sued for brutality, et cetera, Staten Island doesn't have that many cops compared to like Manhattan and the Bronx or Brooklyn, right? I mean, so that's
exactly.
An extraordinary figure.
Yeah, no, thank you for bringing that up. That's very true. Staten Island only until recently had just simply one precinct, the 120, the 120th precinct. They opened a new one, the 121, I believe a few months ago. But yeah, no, that's absolutely true, that given if you also look at the sort of proportionality, the distribution of these officers, that's a very very high number and high proportion of officers who've been sued who work and still make arrests and police the streets here. And yeah, and the lawsuits, you know, many of us here at Legal Aid and other criminal defense attorneys around the city, we file what's called Gissendaner motions to try to get the personnel records of officers who have been accused of brutality or violating people's constitutional rights, and to get their personnel records and what they've been disciplined for within the NYPD. Those records are extremely hard to get, but we try to file them, and particularly in Staten Island, because we have such a high percentage of the officers who have been sued for some of the most egregious abuses, you know, strip searching people on the street, you know, doing full cavity searches for people for routine stops, brutalizing people for not complying with a simple order immediately, and the list just goes on. And that's what we're dealing with here in Staten Island.
Well, let's talk about Eric Garner. You had represented him previous to his being murdered. Tell us about that, and then tell us about what happened to him the day that the cops went after him.
Sure. So, well, I personally did not represent him. My office did, and my colleague, who's also co-author on the Vanity Fair article, Joseph Doyle, he was representing him actively on several open cases at the time he was killed. A few other colleagues of mine had represented him in the past, Catherine Sam, Tamara Giwa, Sung So Lee, I believe Michael Gompers as well. So they, you know, all knew him and had some relationship with him. But Joseph Doyle had was working on taking a case to trial for him. So I know that for many people, particularly Staten Island is such a small community, and we are the primary public defense provider here. We have, of course, an 18B panel, but we don't have another alternate sort of public defense provider like other boroughs do. So a lot of people knew Mr. Garner, either through seeing him in court or, you know, and knew him, as they called him, quote, the gentle giant, who's a large man but known to be incredibly gentle and sweet, father of six. So a lot of people knew him and had a personal relationship with him. So when, you know, the news came out that at first he had been killed and the video came out, it was incredibly difficult, not only for us, but I think even more so for our clients. Many people also knew him. It was all that our clients could talk about in arraignments, just seeing that brutality. People, I think, were more scared seeing that this had happened and a man was killed on video for simply not wanting to be stopped by the police any longer. He was not, as everyone has seen the video, he was not engaging any violence or aggression towards the police. So that was the atmosphere when the video came out. So in terms of, you know, the atmosphere when the non-indictment, the decision of no true bill came out, I believe that was part of your question. For me personally, I was extremely upset and disappointed, but I was not surprised. And we go into that a bit in our article, in that to task a local DA's office to prosecute one of their own, a local member of the local police department, particularly in such a small borough, you're expecting them to fairly prosecute a member of their own, a member of the team. team, one of their colleagues. And there's no system of checks and balances in that. There's, you know, every judge knows they have to recuse themselves on a case if they have a relationship with any of the parties involved. But with the DA, they don't have that obligation, particularly with prosecuting officers. And these are officers that they go with to investigate cases. These are the officers that make the arrests that the DA then prosecute. They work up cases together. They prep them for testifying at trial to be a prosecution witness. So I was not surprised, but I think it's probably the most egregious example. We have video evidence. We have story of eyewitnesses. And still, after how many number of witnesses testified, how much evidence was produced, a medical examiner's report, somehow, magically, there was no indictment. When every public defender out there will tell you, we have all had some of the most flimsy cases with sometimes just an officer testifying, I believe, in the grand jury. Of course, we don't know. We don't get to see the grand jury testimonies or learn everything that goes on. But we've had the weakest of cases indicted. And this case, with all the evidence, is truly egregious that it was not.
Yeah, I'm sitting here, being in Michael Ratner speaking, I'm trying to figure out how it could have happened because of, you know, there's been chokeholds when I was a younger lawyer, and it's unauthorized to be used by police in New York City. You're not supposed to use chokeholds. It's not an authorized technique.
Right.
And, of course, it's a chokehold plus there's two other people on his chest. I mean, it's like inexplicable to me that there wouldn't be some kind of indictment, I mean, even for a manslaughter case.
Negligent homicide.
Something. Tell me about that a little more, and then your article. Go into that a little bit. As I recall, the name of the article is...
Well, so the name of the article is Eric Garner's Public Defender Says Cops and Prosecutors, quote, are a team in every case, unquote. But first, to address the sort of how this could happen and no indictment to come down. And yes, you're absolutely right. And thank you for bringing that up. The chokeholds were banned as a practice a while ago as part of police protocol. So the fact that that was even used, one, was a complete violation of police protocol. And in that scenario, especially. But what we've learned, you know, as we wrote about in the article, grand jury proceedings are completely secret. And the only portions that we as defense attorneys, even the public, learn are minutes of a testifying witness, if that witness is going to testify at the actual trial. And that's when we get that testimony. So then we can cross-examine that witness and compare their testimony in the grand jury to what it is on the stand at trial. But we are not allowed in the grand jury room at any moment except for if our client chooses to testify. And if our client chooses to testify, we can't protect them at all. They take the stand. They are cross-examined by the DA. Everything they say can and will be used against them later. We can't object to anything. We can't advise them in the courtroom, and there's no judge. So the DA serves as the, quote, legal advisor to the grand jury. So they control what the grand jury hears. They can reject what a defense attorney requests be submitted to the grand jury. They control everything, the narrative, what evidence is shown, what witness testifies, what questions a witness is asked. And it would be up to the grand jury to feel empowered enough to ask more questions of the witness and to request the prosecutor ask them these questions. So, but what we've learned with grand jury minutes that have come out in other police violence cases, police misconduct, police brutality cases, what we've learned is we see that when the district attorney directs a witness on the stand, that's a prosecution witness. And they only cross-examine, meaning they're only adversarial with the witness that is either obviously the client who would be the defendant. But when you see that there's a cop on the stand, suddenly the district attorney starts to behave like a defense attorney. Cops are not required, according to the patrol guide, to invoke Miranda on their own the way that the rest of the civilian population within the U.S. is required to do. Cops automatically are granted Miranda and all these protections that other civilians are not. And when a cop is being prosecuted, suddenly the prosecutor is aggressively and adversarially crossing the prosecution witnesses. So any eyewitnesses who would come in as a prosecution witness where they're supposed to be trying to get an indictment on a cop, they would be testifying for the prosecution. But what we've seen in these minutes is the way that the district attorneys question these prosecution witnesses, they're acting like they're cross-examining them. And they're actually trying to break down their testimony and poke holes in the testimony. And that's the role of a defense attorney. The district attorney is supposed to be building that case, but they suddenly become a defense attorney when a cop is on the line.
What happens next in the Garner case? Is there going to be a federal investigation of what happened? Because it's just such a blatant case.
Right. Well, you know, what many communities are hoping is that the DOJ will look into federal charges, and whether it's a federal civil rights deprivation charge, which they can bring against Officer Pantaleo or the New York City Police Department in general, whether it's a civil suit that the family can bring. I mean, there are other avenues, but unfortunately, the state criminal avenue seems to be closed. And even with the DOJ, I believe it's really been the DOJ who's only been successively successful at bringing charges against officers for violations of people's civil rights, constitutional rights, but that doesn't carry as much weight or as much punishment as a sort of state crime charge would, as many of my other clients face for unlicensed driving, for instance, just to show the stark comparison. We have a client right now that's facing felony charges for unlicensed driving, and that carries lots of jail time. But yet, Officer Pantaleo does not face that for killing our client, Mr. Garner. So there is also, of course, political organizing that can happen. It's not, you know, of course, not just through the courts. Courts fail a lot of times in bringing, quote, justice. I think many people don't have faith in the courts to do that. So there's obviously been massive protests in New York and around the country, and even around the world. We've received solidarity messages from Palestine, which is incredibly heartening, I think, especially for the community in Staten Island. There's organizing happening every day. There are demands happening, and you see people in city council, and you see attorneys taking, you know, action as well. So I think you're seeing members of society that are taking it upon themselves to go beyond just what a system that has often failed us and failed our clients.
Yeah, I agree with you, Bina. It's been massive. Yeah. It's been most in many, many years that I've ever seen, both to Garner, obviously, to White and Ferguson, to the Cleveland killings, et cetera. It's been amazing. I think we may be at a real tipping and change point.
Yeah, I agree with you, Michael. It's been nothing like anything I've ever seen since Martin Luther King was assassinated. Yeah. It's really been extraordinary, and I hope it continues.
Wow, this is really interesting, Bina. And I want to recommend people the article. Tell people how to go there.
I believe you can just go to vanityfair.com, and then you can just Google Eric Garner, or the title of the article, Eric Garner's Public Defender Says Cops and Prosecutors Are a Team in Every Case.
Attorney Bina Ahmad, thank you very much for being on Law & Disorder.
Sure, thank you for having me, Michael, and everyone. Thank you. All right, take care.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last week, we were successful in meeting up at Foley Square for that huge demonstration protesting the failure of the grand jury in Staten Island to indict the murderers, the police who killed Eric Garner. You and I met up just by luck, really, Heidi, but there were so many people there. It was like a crowded elevator. We couldn't find our wonderful producer, Jeff Brady. But on his own, Jeff went out there and interviewed some of the people attending the demonstration.
Michael, I'm actually glad that we had the problem of too many people so we couldn't make our way there, because it was a great turnout. Jeff Brady, we want to thank him for going there and recording voices of demonstrators assembling at Foley Square during what was, I believe, the first large mass protest against the grand jury decision, failing to indict those officers responsible for choking Eric Garner to death. Let's take a listen now to some of the voices at that protest.
My name is Masai Lawyer. I'm a staff attorney for the Legal Aid Society. I think it's important to be here. I think that we have to show solidarity with the community, with the family, with Eric Garner's family. And we got to protest this unjust decision. I mean, it's unfortunate that we have a system that disproportionately impacts people of color, poor people, people who don't have the access to the, a lot of things that the people who do have money have access to in this country. And we need to come out here and show solidarity and our support to the community and the people who are most affected by this. I think it was a gross injustice. You have a rule to homicide. You have videotape. You know, you have pretty much everything you need in order to get an indictment. So it kind of shows a double standard. And look, you know, the reality is that our clients don't get that special treatment. You know, our clients are going to get indicted if they have them on videotape, and they're going to get a charge, at least manslaughter or criminal negligent homicide. So, I mean, the reality is that there's a double standard for police officers that doesn't apply to average New York citizens. I mean, a chokehold is clearly a violation of New York Police Department policy. But beyond that, you know, there was ample opportunity while the hold was taking place to release the pressure, and he told them that I can't breathe. He made it quite clear that, you know, he was struggling to survive. So this idea that just because he started chokehold, he had to finish it. First of all, chokehold isn't proper, but he started a chokehold, he had to finish a chokehold all the way till he died. Well, that's ridiculous. I think it's important for us to show our support in the community. I think we have to show that, you know, these lives matter, black lives matter, poor people lives matter, and we need to get out on the streets and talk to our politicians and get involved and ensure that, you know, people are held accountable when they make these decisions, and that we're not going to stop fighting until we get justice.
Echo, we want freedom, all these racist telecoms, we don't need them, Echo, we want freedom.
My name is Matthew Allen. The reason that I'm here is because I wanted to observe to see the people, what kind of people and who are out supporting the injustices that have been going on in the United States for some time now. I wanted to do something. I didn't want to just sit around and not do anything. I felt that compelled to be out here to make sure that I show the support in some way, shape, or form, and to hopefully gain inspiration to find something much more constructive to do to help bring about the change that this country needs, rather than just holding signs up and making chants, which is admirable for now, but for the future we're going to need to do something much more drastic and much more constructive in order to gauge the change ourselves. People don't understand, when people say they need to get out and vote, it's not necessarily important to go out and vote for the president or the mayor or anything like that. It's the people in their own backyards, their community board leaders, you know, the representatives in Congress and things of that nature. Those are the people who are looking out for you on a much more immediate scale. Those are the type of people that really need to be paid attention to. And that's a good point about community. You know, you have to make sure that the people that are closest to you is looking out for your best interests, because they'll help you more immediately than somebody that's from afar that can only help people on a large scale.
I'm here today because Black Lives do matter. It's outrageous that this continues to happen, and people make the argument that justice has been served. But if this is our justice system, that it needs to be reformed, and it needs to be reformed now, because I cannot continue to have people who look like me, people who look like my nephews, people who look like my brothers, people who look like my fathers, continue to be killed and nothing happens. This is injustice, and the system needs to be reformed now, right now.
What do you think about this turnout?
I think it's beautiful. I mean, we live in a city where rallies are not uncommon, but what you see here is people coming together who look totally different. People from all walks of life, people from all parts of the city, people from out of town who are here because they know that what is continuing to happen is not right.
Janelle, and I'm a teacher of elementary school kids, and they understand what's going on. If not the the context, but they understand the feeling and they understand the emotion. So I'm out here for them because they're not going to be out here. So I'm out there. I'm out here for them.
So what are you going to bring back to them?
Hope. I think that's why a lot of people are out here. And justice, and that there are ways that they can participate, if not by being out here, but by other ways and giving their support. Helping out in their own communities, because I work in a school in Bed-Stuy, so they understand a lot of this already, innately, even if they don't have the words for it. So for them, giving them a sense of justice in the world that we're going to hand to them. So.
However, there was no justice in this case.
No.
Right. And how are you going to impart that information, if I might ask?
First, to process it for myself before I try and process it with them. And try and figure out a way to explain that the system can change, but it won't happen overnight. It might not happen in my lifetime, maybe in their lifetime, maybe in their kids' lifetime, but that we keep doing things like this and we keep fighting for change in as many ways as possible so that something will happen one day.
This is not an isolated incident with what happened on Staten Island or in Ferguson, Missouri. This has been happening since America has been America. And hopefully there is a movement to really make some change now. I'm hoping that this is less about the individual cases themselves, about what happened on Staten Island, what happened in Ferguson, because the details are unclear to me from what I'm getting from the news media. In terms of what happened in those specific incidents, but in general, this needs to change. White cops are killing black unarmed people, and that's got to change.
My name is Barbara Owens, and I'm here because, once again, the justice system of the United States has failed us. Once again, they issued a verdict that said black lives don't matter. We will not and we cannot accept this verdict. I personally am very angry. I cannot believe that we continue to have a country where black people who helped build this country, who worked as hard as anyone else, continues to be mistreated. And it's not even, sometimes there has to be the spirit of the law. When you say to me that someone is guilty of something, like selling his own cigarettes, okay, I'll buy it. But if I had been a white guy selling my own cigarettes, you would have walked up to me and said, excuse me, sir, that's illegal. Put it in your pocket and move on. That's what I want. I want you to walk up to me selling an illegal cigarette and say, excuse me, mister, it's illegal. Put it in your pocket and walk on. And until that day happens, there's not much anybody can say to me about, oh, it's going to be better. We're working at it. Quite frankly, we're tired of working at it. Why should we continue to have to work at it? But we will, because we don't have any other choice. So I'm here tonight, cold and all, to say, Black Lives Matter!
I was in the Bronx, which is where I live, and I was walking down the street. I was going to visit somebody. Sort of zoned out just walking, and I happened to look ahead of me coming down this particular block, and there were a group of what were obviously undercover policemen. You know, I could see guns on their hips, you know. Of course, I didn't want to walk through the middle of that, so I decided to step off the curb and go around them. As soon as I stepped off the curb, I was grabbed by one or two undercover cops. And immediately, I had to have an awareness that the arm they grabbed had to go dead for me. I couldn't move it. I couldn't have any sort of muscle twitch, because I was aware that if they sensed anything like that, I could have been beaten, arrested, killed, I don't know where it could have gone. So all these things had to go through my mind while they searched me, asked me if I took my ID, checked for warrants, asked me if I had any warrants, which I don't know why they would have taken my word for it anyway, and it is their job to check. And I do have the right not to incriminate myself, even if I did have warrants out. However, the things that go through your mind, especially as a male of color, when you're on an interaction with police, is a million. Your attention is focused on them. It's focused on what you have to do to hopefully not be beaten, arrested, or killed. And it's just an awareness that you have to have all the time. You know, they do interesting little tactics. A cop in a car or in a scooter will ride. Well, you know, I've had instances where a police officer in a scooter will swerve and ride directly at me in an attempt to see if I'll flee or do something else. And I'm looking at him like, what are you doing? You know, and he just turns and goes about his business. You know, a lot of phishing techniques, a lot of entrapment techniques, you know, because, again, their job isn't to prevent crime, it's to make arrests. To Eric Gardner, they should have, if they wanted to do it, if they wanted to have some sort of interaction, ask him for his identification, because that's one of the things they do. Issued him a summons, because selling loose cigarettes is not a jail time offense. It is not an offense where you are supposed to die, right? There was no reason why they needed all those police officers to interact with him. But that is another thing that frequently happens when police deal with individuals of color. You know, you'll frequently see three, five or more police officers for one individual of color. You know, if they did not have any evidence that he actually sold a loose cigarette at that time, they should have left the scene. Because they could not prove any crime had been committed or any misdemeanor had been committed. It was not an arrest situation. It was a summons situation. You know, the mayor and the police commissioner came out a couple of weeks ago saying that people who were found in possession of small amounts of marijuana will not be arrested. Does that mean they will be shot? Does that mean they will have a chokehold put on them and die? It's selling loose cigarettes is less of an offense than having marijuana in your possession. You know? Their procedures are misguided and archaic in some degree and discriminatory and racist in others. These things are not enforced evenly, equally, and clearly all people in the city are not treated the same, you know, and that is a big problem, and that's why one of the reasons this rally is happening. It is just horrendous, you know. Again, these are Eric Gardner's taxes paid these officers, you know. They're his employees. You know? They approached him with no courtesy, no professionalism, and no respect. The slogans that are written on the sides of their patrol cars, they manifested none of that. In a more affluent neighborhood, would they have approached someone differently who was selling loose cigarettes? Probably. But Eric Gardner didn't get that treatment. And that's a huge injustice, regardless of the color of his skin. That's a huge injustice. But it was because of the color of his skin why he got that type of treatment. I think a lot of people know that. A lot of people have difficulty actually believing that. They don't want to believe it, you know, because it would mean that, you know, what they have come to believe isn't true. You know, what they've been told countless times isn't true. But unfortunately, they don't experience it firsthand. So then everything becomes up for debate. You know, we want everyone who puts on a badge, you know, to be able to come home safe, but, you know, and be safe. But there are standards. It is a job that, you know, you should be held accountable for doing it, for the way in which you conduct yourself on that job. And there should be consequences.
Roy, thank you very much.
We say fight back!
You say get back!
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 We say fight back!
Well, my name is Joseph Umpa. I'm here because, you know, it's just gotten to a point. You know, one of the things I have to agree with in terms of Al Sharpton, when he recently said in reference to that the grand jury is to convene to decide whether or not something should go to trial. The grand jury is not the trial. So when the grand jury decides that they're not going to indict, even though there is a videotape which clearly would indicate that there should be probable cause in reference to the incident, as Commissioner Bracken himself said, it looked like a chokehold to me. The fact that the system, Staten Island, which is still part of the city, anyway, the system has allowed this to perpetuate is what is troubling and is what is dangerous. Because this is only building something that at some point they will not be able to stop. I mean, it's part of a pattern, but it's not a new pattern. If you look at the numbers in terms of unarmed blacks being killed by police officers, you'll see that it has been rising, okay? I saw those statistics in Daily Kos, anyway. But, so it's part of a pattern. And, you know, if we don't stand up for ourselves, and fortunately others realize this and are standing with black people, it won't stop. You know, it's not something that's going to stop by itself. Well, you know, the rally is just a start, and in one sense, the rally is a reaction to the decision, and you can see people are venting their emotional, their rage, their anger, their frustration. It is really about concrete action, and part of that concrete action is compelling the system to do the right thing. And that happens when people not only voice in terms of, you know, marches, but also in terms of letters to their elected officials and emails to elected officials and letting them understand the ramifications of if you sit back and do nothing, then something will happen to you. And what I mean by that is that you will not be elected, you will not be allowed to continue. So when they say shut it down, what they're talking about is this system which keeps repeating this needs to be shut down. The, you know, the greed on Wall Street, all of it is contained. This is economic inequality. All of this, it all comes together, you know.
Ms. Margarita Rosario, unfortunately, I'm one of the parents that also lost a child to police brutality. On January 12th, my son Anthony Rosario received 14 shots to his back while he was face down on the floor. My nephew Hilton Vega received 8 shots to his back while he was also down on the face down on the floor. This happened by Patrick Bronson and James Crow, who were former bodyguard to former Mayor Giuliani, on January 12, 1995. When my son was killed, Bratton was in office, and he's in office again. When my son was killed, Mayor Giuliani at that time called the 46th precinct to congratulate Patrick Bronson and James Crow on a job well done. This is the kind of mayor that he was, and this is the kind of commissioner that we had then, that every 2 weeks a young man was being murdered and killed in the hands of police. There's a film based on my story called Justifiable Homicide.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org. on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.